It is good to be back with all of you. If you are new, welcome. We actually started a brand new series, it seems like months ago now, but at the beginning of this year, we started this series called On the Other Side Of, which I'm really excited to talk about with you. The principle that we kind of started with last time we were here was this, that where we want to be is often on the other side of what we don't want to do. And I think we all understand this principle when it comes to just natural, just everyday life. There's always goals and destinations that we have in mind, and there's always challenges and you know, obstacles that get in the way of that. When it comes to the spiritual life, when it comes to spiritual growth and things of that nature, our Christian life, there's, I think, a disconnect. And I think it's because, maybe I'm wrong, but because salvation, that whole process kind of came so easily for us, this idea of, you know, raise your hand, pray a prayer, stand up, you know, and just kind of have this conversation with God, saying, God, I trust you. That was really easy. And so some of us think, well, the rest of the Christian life must be this easy. And then we find out it's not. And we're going, God, what's the deal? I thought this was going to be easy. And God's saying, no, I didn't promise that. That, you know, it's going to be actually quite hard. There's lots of things that I want you to do. And we're thinking, well, God, you know, I thought you were responsible and you're, you know, in control. And God's saying, well, I am, but you're also responsible for things. Here's the things that I want you to do to obey me and to live out the Christian life. And that, for us, can be sometimes hard because we just don't think in those kind of terms as far as the challenges, the obstacles. But God says there are. There's things that you need to do. It's work. It's work to being a Christ follower. And we don't like to talk about work often because we don't want to confuse work with the gospel. And we said the gospel is that God saves you by grace through faith. You don't have to earn your way into heaven, right? And we said the gospel is opposed to earning, not striving. And so this idea of earning our way is something we want to say, no, there's no such thing as earning your way to heaven. But when it comes to the Christian life itself, as far as after you become a Christ follower, it is challenging. It is hard work. And one of the reasons it's hard work is because God calls us to do things, as I said, that we don't really want to do. Like, I don't know anybody who wakes up in the morning and says, I can't wait to forgive someone today. You know, oh, I just can't wait, you know. I don't know anybody who looks forward to praying for their enemies. I don't just know anybody. Maybe that's you, but not me. You know, there's things that God calls us to do that we just don't really want to do. And one of the reasons why we don't want to do it or why it's hard is because we don't really understand why God is calling us to do those things. We just don't get it. There's not a reason in our minds why we should do what he's calling us to do. And maybe a great illustration of this is from a movie, and I'm going to date myself. If you're my age, around my age or older, you've probably heard of this movie. If you're younger, maybe not. But this movie was set in the 1900s, okay, for you young people. This was the movie The Hunt for the Red October. Anybody remember this movie? I think it was 1990, right? It was a classic. You had Sean Connery, who played the old James Bond, who was this submarine captain for this Russian submarine called the Red October. It was the most advanced submarine at the time. And this is a Tom Clancy novel, so there's a Jack Ryan character played by Alec Baldwin in this movie, too. And in this scene, so, you know, Sean Connery is the captain of the submarine, and at this point, most of the crew of the submarine had already left the ship, and there was the captain, a few of his crew members, but also Jack Ryan, played by Alec Baldwin, and some of the American crew members as well, along with the captain of the submarine. And they're in this submarine, and they, all of a sudden, they find out there's this torpedo coming at them. And so Sean Connery tells Jack Ryan, who's sitting behind the steering wheel, to turn to 513, you know, kind of one ping only, Captain, you know. And so Jack Ryan is, I know that's terrible, isn't it? That's my best. That's my best. We'll compete later, Dave, on who's got the better ones. But he says, turn to 513 or whatever. And so he's turning it. And the American submarine captain's going, that's crazy. That's turning right into the torpedo. You're going to get us all killed, right? And so Jack Ryan has to make the decision. Should he turn into the torpedo and listen to the Russian captain, or should he listen to the American captain? And he decides he's going to turn into the torpedo, and maybe because it's the awesome accent of Sean Connery, I don't know what it was, but he decides to listen to Sean Connery. By the way, he has a British accent. Did anybody notice that in the movie? He's Russian, but it's still a British accent. But he turns into, it's just weird, turns into the torpedo, and suddenly now there's this collision course happening, and they're counting down when the torpedo is about to hit the submarine. You know, 3, 2, 1, and everybody holds their breath, and the torpedo hits the submarine but does not explode. And all of a sudden, the American captain goes, ah, you see the light bulbs go on. He's like, the Russian captain was brilliant. He actually, because he went into the torpedo, changed and did not allow the torpedo enough time to actually get the triggered mechanism on the torpedo, and he cut the distance, and so the torpedo wasn't armed yet to explode. And so it was a brilliant move. And you know, and Jack Ryan is going, what's happened? What's happening? So they explained this to him. But when he turned into that torpedo, he didn't know that was going to happen. He just trusted in the captain that he knew what he was talking about. And I think the same is true with God oftentimes. God calls us to do something that seems like, I don't get it. I don't understand. And oftentimes it seems like the opposite thing of what we should do. You know, for example, for some of you, you read in the scriptures and you read that all over the place it says that we need to give monetarily. And it's like, wait a minute, there's no exception clause to these give monetarily commands. It's just give, you know? And it's like, wait, shouldn't it be based on how much I earn or how much I give or how much I save? You know, I just need to give? That doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I'm not in a position or I feel like I'm having a hard enough time to making ends meet, and you want me to give monetarily? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Or for some of you, maybe you're in a marriage and it's just struggling right now. It's just hard. And you talk to your best friends and your best friends are telling you, you just need to get out of it. You just need to get out of it. You just need to get out of it. But then you read scripture, you get some wise counsel, and all they're saying is stay in, stay in, stay in. And that just, for you, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. For some of you who are adults, and maybe you've been married before, but you're not married now, or maybe you've never been married, but you read some of the things in scripture about sexual morality and keeping the marriage bed pure, and you're going, you want me to do what? You want me to stop doing what? You want me to start being celibate? You know, I can understand if you're a teenager with these verses, but I'm an adult. You know, I've been married before. I'm living with somebody now. You want me to stop doing what now? Come on, that just doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense socially. That doesn't make any sense culturally. That doesn't make any sense biologically. You know, you want me to do what? Or maybe for some of you, you feel like God is kind of prodding at you to maybe start looking into the ministry field or in the mission field. And you're going, wait, I already have a good job. I have a job that I went to school with, you know, for, and I have a job that pays the bills. And you want me to, God, you want me to leave all that and start getting some education for that? That just doesn't make any sense as you consider who's all involved and all the things that would take place. God, I don't know about that. You see, this is kind of one of the fun things about being a Christ follower. You know, there are times, and I'm not saying they happen often, but there are times when you read scripture or when you hear a sermon like this, or you read a Christian book, or you're talking to some friends, or getting some counsel, and you suddenly realize God is calling you to do something that just doesn't, you know, seem like that's what you would normally do. It almost seems like maybe the opposite thing of what you should do, and you're going, God, I don't know about this. I don't understand why. I don't see the connection. And the good news with all this, as we talk about this, is that God is a very reasonable God. That God never asks us to do something that he doesn't have a reason behind, at least from his perspective. And oftentimes, God gives us the reason why. I mean, he says, love your wives, and he gives the reason why. And he says to do this, and he gives the reason why. But there are times when God says, here's what I want you to do, here's the direction I want you to go, but I'm not going to tell you why. And in those times, we just want to rebel against God and say, God, I'm not angry with you. God, I have nothing against you. But God, I'm not going to do that because I don't understand. I don't know why you are calling me to do this. God, if you just tell me why, you know, that's one thing. But if I don't understand why, if I don't see the connection, then I don't really want to do that. And so if that's you this morning, if you've been there or if you're there in that position right now, or if you will be there, which I think probably us all will at one point in our lives or another, this talk, I think, will be so helpful for you of explaining not just, you know, why God does what he does, but what we should do about it. So if you have your Bibles, turn with me to the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings is a book that we normally don't go to on a regular basis, but it's filled with incredible stories of what God did through people in Israel and the prophets and all that. But this story really isn't about an Israelite so much. This story is about someone who is really an outsider coming into Israel. His name was Naaman. And this story, I think, is going to be so helpful for all of us as to really, again, what it is that we're supposed to do and why God does what he does. But here's how the story begins in verse 1 of chapter 5 of 2 Kings. He says this, "Now Naaman was the commander of the army of the king of Aram." So we're introduced to this guy named Naaman, but we're also introduced to this country named Aram. And Aram isn't one of those, or Aram is another way of pronouncing it. It's not one of those famous countries in the ancient Middle East like Egypt. Aram was actually located on the east side, northeast side of northern Israel. So here's a map of Israel. The green is Aram, so it's up there in the northeast quadrant there. And so it was a country not really famous, most people know. It's in present-day Syria. But we're introduced to a guy named Naaman who is the second in command of this entire country. And so here's what the author says. "Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him, the Lord," that's interesting, "the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier." So we're introduced to Naaman. He is successful. He is rich. He is powerful. He is brave. You know, all those great qualities that every, you know, especially guys would love to have. He's kind of one of those man's man kind of thing. But it says, there's a catch. But he had leprosy. And leprosy in that time, was getting that diagnosis, was basically like getting diagnosed with cancer or maybe like AIDS back in the 80s or 90s. There wasn't a lot known about leprosy. They just knew it was incurable. You did not want it. And so, you know, it was one of those things, if you got it, you were excommunicated from the community. You were kind of ostracized because of it. So here's this guy, Naaman, who has so much going for him. He has all these victories, but now he's been diagnosed and been given leprosy, in a sense. And not really given, but he just got it. And so it's like, oh no, what do I do? But fortunately, I think because he was so favored by the king, as we're going to see, that he's allowed to keep his position as second in command. Now, the other interesting thing about this country, Aram, apparently they didn't like to, you know, grow their own crops or mine their own gold. They just liked to head all over into the northern Israelites and actually go into their territory and raid their land and steal their crops and steal their gold and steal anything of value, including women and children. And so here's what happens next. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel. And she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So apparently in one of these raiding parties that went out from Aram to northern Israel, they got captured this young girl. And apparently she was old enough at that time to remember what life was like in northern Israel, but young enough to quickly attach herself to the household that she was living with. So apparently she found her way into Naaman's household as a servant girl. And so when she discovered that Naaman had leprosy, she goes to Naaman's wife and says, "Listen, I think I know about a guy that can maybe help your husband. I know about a guy who has this kind of, you know, kind of magical powers who could heal Naaman if Naaman would go to him." And so she tells, you know, Naaman's wife about this. Naaman's wife then goes to Naaman and says, "I know this is a long shot, but here's the story from this one of our slave girls. What do you think?" And so Naaman decides he's going to do something with this information. He's going to go to his king, his boss, and see if he can go over. So here's what happens. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. And so he says, "Excuse me, king, sorry to interrupt. You know, here's the information I have. What do you think?" Now, I don't know if this was a hard sell or not for Naaman. I don't know if this would be like going to our bosses today and saying, "Listen, you know, I heard of this witch doctor in India who could, you know, cure me of my disease." You know, I don't know if this was like really crazy idea or not, but I think because Naaman was so favored by the king's response was just incredible. Here's what the king said to all this. He says, "By all means, go," the king replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. basically everything one would need to impress a person of that kind of power, a position who could heal an incurable disease like leprosy. And so he sends all this stuff, including this letter. And awesome, the awesome part about Scripture is we have the details of the letter. We know what the king wrote to the other king. Here's what the letter said. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter, I'm sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of leprosy." Now, the reason that the king of Aram writes to the king of Israel saying, you need to cure him, because the mindset in that day was if someone had the kind of power to cure leprosy, something like leprosy, surely he must be the king. Surely he must be in the position of power, because he had that kind of power to do that, then you know, everybody would have made him king by now. And so he writes to the king saying, you need to cure Naaman of leprosy. And so Naaman is given this letter, he's given all these supplies, he's also given some servants, and he's headed to northern Israel. And so he gets an audience with the king of Israel. And here's what happens next. As soon as the king of Israel read, or as soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." In other words, you just kind of picture this. Naaman, who's this kind of arch nemesis to the king of Israel, asks for an audience. And so the king says, okay. And so Naaman walks in, hands the king of Israel a letter. The king opens it up and reads from the king of Aram, "Here's my servant Naaman. I want you to cure him of his leprosy." You know, and this king is just minding his own business. He has no idea what's going on. He reads this as going, what is this about? And then he goes, wait a minute. I get it now. I get it. If I just send you back and not healed you, you know, then that your king is just going to use this as an excuse to pick a fight with me. I see what your king's doing. He's just trying to start a quarrel. He knows I can't cure you of leprosy. I mean, who can do that? And so he's just trying to do this as a way to pick a fight with me. And so he gets all angry because he knows what the king of Aram is actually trying to do, at least in his mind. But fortunately, the word gets out about Naaman and his leprosy and the fact that he's over in northern Israel to another person whose name Elisha. He was one of probably the most powerful, I think, of the Old Testament prophets. Elijah was his predecessor, and Elisha was even more powerful than Elijah. And so word gets to Elisha, and here's what happens. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. He says, "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me," and this is such an important piece, "and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So here's what happened. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." In other words, and this is kind of where you have to begin to start using your imagination a little bit more. Elisha lived in probably where most people did, in just small villages. And so whenever these villagers saw this dust the cloud of horses coming their way, chances are they're thinking, oh, great, here comes the Arameans again, or a raiding party. We better get out of Dodge. You know, let's get our most valuable, you know, possessions. Let's get our women and children, and let's get out of town before they show up. And so by the time Naaman shows up to this village and to Elisha's house, probably most people are gone. And, you know, Naaman's probably thinking that Elisha's going to be there. He's going to be so honored that Naaman, you know, this great, you know, leader is going to be there to get help from him. But there's like nobody, you know. It's like it's kind of a ghost town, if you can picture it. All there is this messenger that comes along as Naaman's waiting around. There's this messenger, maybe a messenger boy coming along saying, "Hey, are you Naaman? And, you know, I got this message for you. Here's what Elisha wants you to do. He wants you to go down to the Jordan and dip 7 times in the river, and you'll be cleansed." And you can just imagine Naaman going, "What? Do you even know who I am? Do you know what the lengths it took me to get here? I had to bother my king, I had to bother your king, and now you, this little messenger, Elijah's not even here. This messenger's telling me to go and take a bath in the Jordan. Are you kidding me? Where are the cameras? You know, this has got to be some kind of joke." And the messenger's going, you know, "Don't shoot the messenger," but that's the message. And Naaman's just getting all angry. In fact, here's what happens. But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought I thought, that's interesting, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord, his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in a rage. In other words, he says, listen, I this whole thing, I thought this was all going to go down differently. Right? And Naaman does what I think some of us do. We kind of have this picture of how God is going to work or how things are going to be played out. And in his mind, he was going to come. Elisha would be there and be so honored by his presence. And he would wave his hand, you know, this kind of a magical, wave his hand over the leprosy, say some magical words, you know, put a potion on him, something, and his leprosy would be cured. But now he's just standing there going, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? I got to go down to the Jordan and bathe? What's that all about? And here in this story is where it really begins to connect with us, I think, in real life. See, Naaman's issue is oftentimes our issue, and it's that we don't see the connection between our problem and God's solution. For Naaman, he could not see how these two things were connected. He could not see how his incurable disease of leprosy had anything to do with going to the Jordan River and taking a bath and dipping seven times. He could not see the connection. And for so many of us, we oftentimes too, when God tells us to do something or lead us to something, it's like, I just don't see the connection. We're kind of like Naaman, standing outside Elisha's house going, what are you talking about? Getting angry. Why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense to me. And we don't see it. And Naaman's real issue or dilemma is oftentimes, you know, our dilemma. And the question that really, I think, for Naaman and for us, we have to answer is this, that will I trust God when he withholds the why? Will I trust God when he says to move, to go in this direction, to stop doing this, to start doing this, and we don't see the connection and we don't understand why? And the question is, will we trust him? Because at the end of the day, it's really all about trust. The Christian life, in essence, is all about trust. In fact, any good relationship is built really on one thing. It's trust. And when God says to move, the question is, will I trust him enough, knowing and trusting that he has my best intentions in mind? Will I go even though I may not know the reasons why? Now, before we get back into our story, that's the question I think we wrestle with is, well, why does God do that way? Why does God oftentimes withhold the why? And the answer is, it's not because he doesn't know the reasons. I think the answer is oftentimes because he knows how we are. That when we get the reasons, we tend to just kind of lean into those reasons and lean into our own logic. You know, it's like, why did you do that? Well, you know, and we'll say, well, here's reason one, here's reason two, and here's reason three. Well, what about God? Oh, yeah, God, you know, that kind of thing too. And we kind of, you know, forget about God. See, our tendency is to go just from the what to the why, and we miss the who. We go from the what, here's what I'm supposed to be doing, to the why, here's the reasons behind it, and we totally miss the who. We miss the fact that it's God who is telling us, God saying, trust me with this. And I find this is so true, especially if you've been a Christ follower for a while. You've developed these habits, these patterns, these disciplines where you're obediently following God and you know the reasons behind it, right? And you can see the benefits from it. And it's like, well, why are you doing that? Well, here's reason one, here's reason two. Well, what about God? Didn't God tell you to? Oh, yeah, God told me. That's how I got, you know, and we kind of forget about the whole fact that God told us to do it. But every so often, God comes along and he kind of shakes our little boat and says, here's what I want you to do, and I'm not going to give you the reason why. I just want you to trust me. Trust that I have your best intentions in mind. I heard it illustrated this way. Imagine two guys who have, you know, two different stockbrokers. The first guy gets a phone call from a stockbroker and says, I want you to buy this stock, and here's the reasons why I want you to buy it. So the guy goes, okay, I'm going to buy the stock. And then another guy finds out this guy bought the stock, and he asks, well, why did you buy the stock? And it's like, well, here's reason one, and here's reason two, and here's reason three. Oh, okay. But the other guy gets a phone call from his stockbroker, and the stockbroker says, I want you to buy the stock. But he says, I'm not going to tell you why. You just got to trust me. And then that guy gets a phone call from another guy and says, hey, why did you buy this stock? And you know what that guy's going to say? It's not reason one, reason two, or reason three. It's because my stockbroker told me, and I trust him. Now, I'm not saying that's a good way to buy stock, right? But you see what I'm saying? It shifts from the reason, you know, to the person, right? And we can do that. We can shift from actually the opposite way. We can shift from the person who's telling us to do it to the reasons why, and we can miss the person all together. We can miss the fact that this is the God who's telling us to do this. But that's hard for us because we want to know this question. God, what's on the other side of obedience? God, why should I do this? Give me the reasons. You know, why? You know, as parents, you know when our kids ask us why, what do we say? Right? You guys know it. That's the next line, because I said so. And is that enough for us as parents? You betcha, right? I told you to clean your room. Why? Because I said so. That's why, and that should be enough. But it's interesting, when God tells us that, for whatever reason, that's not enough for us. God, I got to know why. I got to be able to connect the dots. I got to know what's on their side. And God says, just trust me. Just trust me. Because I want to make sure that you remember, it's not just all about it's really all about trusting me. That's the essence of this relationship. Now, getting back to the story of Naaman, fortunately, you know, picture Naaman here. He's on the outside of Elisha's house, just angry. You know, he's just upset. Everything that had planned had just gone to the, you know, it's just not working out. But fortunately, Naaman's, one of his servants, offers some, I think, really incredible wisdom and insight. Fortunately, he has some good counsel with him. Here's what Naaman's servant said. He said, Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" In other words, Naaman, come on. If Elijah actually showed up and said, "Here's what I want you to do to be cured. I want you to go and sail the seven seas or climb this mountain or slay this dragon or kill this giant," you would have done that. To you, that would have made more sense. To go on some epic adventure to earn, you know, to kind of get what you were looking for, you would have done that, wouldn't you? You know? All he's asking you to do is go to the Jordan and just take a bath, you know, dip seven times. Well, I mean, what harm would that do? Just try it out. Just see what happens. And so here's what he does. He went down and he dipped himself in the Jordan seven times, as the man of God told him. And I don't even have to tell you how the story ends, do I? Right? And his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all of his attendants went back to the man of God. They found Elisha. He stood before him and said, and this is the point of the talk. He says, now I know that there's no God in all the world except in Israel. Now I get it. Now I see. Now I understand. Before I didn't see the connection between the two. But now I know. And this is the thing when it comes to obedience. And this is the principle this morning. Understanding. We want understanding. We want to know why. We want to see clearly. We want all this stuff. Understanding is oftentimes on the other side of obedience. God says, I have a reason, but I'm not going to tell you the reason on this side. Oftentimes, I just want you to trust me, and you'll discover why on the other side of obedience. Now, the real tragedy that fortunately Naaman avoided, but for some of us, we don't, is that when you say no to God, it's not that there's like these consequences that just come with it. There are plenty of consequences that come with it. That's why God says no, because to protect us. But when we say no to God, it's not only that we have these natural consequences, but oftentimes we end up just missing God in the whole process. We end up missing him. When we allow our obedience to intersect with his power, suddenly God becomes that much more real, that much more powerful, that much more, you know, everything in our lives. We begin to experience God in whole new and fresh ways that we wouldn't if we had just said no to God. And see, here's the thing. You and I, we just don't know what hangs in the balance when God says, here's what I want you to do. And I'm not going to tell you why. I just want you to do it. We don't know what hangs in the balance until oftentimes we do it. And sometimes understanding comes when we disobey, right? Sometimes for some of you, you were told, here's what God wants you to do, and you didn't do it, and you didn't understand why at the time, but so you didn't do it. But now you know why he told you, but now you have those regrets. Now you have those memories. Now you have those things that you got to explain to your kids. But wouldn't you want to, like, that, but without the regrets, the understanding without all that? And God says sometimes it's just on the other side of obedience. You got to trust me first. And you'll understand in good time, but just trust me. Now, that's a story that, you know, that happened thousands of years ago. What I wanted to do to kind of and really kind of bring this into present day life is to invite Katie Jensen up. Katie, if you were here with us maybe a month and a half ago, I don't really remember. Things are a blur anymore when you don't have church. But Katie Jensen had surgery to donate one of her kidneys. And we prayed for her, and the surgery was a success. But this whole process was just very curious to me, because that's something that just normally people just don't decide to donate a kidney. At least I don't know very many people who do that. They probably should, but I just don't know of very many. And just knowing you, just knowing where you were at, and you know, family life and busyness and just everything, but you really felt like God was kind of leading you this way. And I just wanted, first of all, why a kidney? Of all the things, why donate a kidney? And I got other questions, but why don't you start with that one?
So our church puts on a ladies' event each December, the Favorite Things Party. And so not this past one, but the one before, so 2017, the speaker talked about donating a kidney. And at the time, I didn't really know much about living organ donation or that it was a thing or anything. So I looked into it a bit more and found out that the common things that you can donate as a living organ donor are the kidney and the liver. If you're pregnant, you can donate your, what's it called? Darn it, I can't,
what's it? Liver? What?
Donate if what? You're pregnant, you can donate like.
Placenta.
Yes, thank you. If you're pregnant, you can donate your placenta. I don't know. I'm not pregnant. I don't know these things.
I only know that because that's what she said first hour, and I'm trusting her. That's usually a word that does not enter my mouth on this stage.
But you can. But that wasn't, you know. So you could donate bone marrow.
What is placenta? Yes. For one, yeah, sorry.
500 points,
yes.
So there's all kinds. There's several different things that you can donate. And the places around here that you can do it through are UC or Ohio State. So I went through UC, and you fill out the same form, whether it's liver or kidney donation, and you fill out the same form, give it back to them, and to be honest, is kind of hoping for the liver because they only take a portion of it, and it regenerates within 3 months, so that seemed a lot easier than like a whole organ being taken and just gone, but when they called me back, it was for the kidney, so that's why I chose kidney, because it wasn't a choice, that's just what they said.
Okay. But you felt like God was leading you to donate this organ. And I have felt like God leading me to donate my organs after I die, right? I mean, I've got the card. But why did you decide to do it? I mean, I looked at you and I talked with you. You were so confident. This was like God, you know, how did you get to the point where you felt like this was God really leading you and pressing upon you to do this?
So after I heard someone talk about donating a kidney, it was just kind of in my mind, and then as the months went by, I felt like God was just putting it on my heart more and more and more as time went by. And then I was like, okay, let's, you know, look into this, let's do this, I was praying about it. And then you have to go in and do a bunch of testing, and so, you know, I don't even know if I'm going to be a candidate for donating, and who knows, maybe I'm not a candidate, maybe God's just leading me to do this so that I can tell other people about it and someone else will do this. I don't know.
You don't know why. Right?
I don't know.
You don't know why. Right.
So, but I felt God was leading me that way. So it's like, okay, well, let's do this. And got tested and found out I was a candidate for it. Another concern was my job at the time. When you donate, you're out for a couple weeks, a few weeks of work, and then when you come back, you're not all the way at 100%. And my work at the time wasn't the greatest, and it was like, kind of worried that they're going to find a reason to fire me when I tell them about this. But it's like, God's leading me to do this, so I'm just going to do it. And then God brought a new job and just provided this new job for me, which for so many reasons has been great. But one of the big ones has been that they have been so supportive through all of this. And then as time went by, so because I didn't go into kidney donation already knowing who I was going to donate to, it was just whoever I was matched with.
That's another crazy part for me. Like, I can see if someone came to you and said, can I have a kidney? But you're just like, I'm just going to give a kidney to whoever needs it. That's awesome.
So because of that, I can kind of choose a time frame a little bit on when that's going to happen. And so I talked with my boss and we decided like November, December time frame. It's like, all right, great. A little bit nervous because I was supposed to speak at the favorite things party. And I was like, ooh, we'll see how that works out. And then I got a call. It's really quick when everything happens. So I got a call and it's about a week and a half before the surgery. And they called and gave me the surgery date and worked out really well because it was 3 days after favorite things. So I still got to talk for that, which is nice. And then they said, you know, you're not going to be able to drive for a couple weeks and you're not going to be able to, like, you're not going to be up and moving around for a while. And so that was another concern because our foster son, I take him to daycare and get him ready in the morning and my husband has to be at work before daycare even opens. So it's like, how's that going to work? And my mom lives in Florida for the winter, and she was coming back for Christmas and had already planned to stay a bit longer than, you know, what she would have normally stayed. And so without having to change any airline tickets or anything, she flew into Ohio 2 days before my surgery, and then she was able to fly out a few weeks later. And it was right after I was able to drive again. So, like, the timing of that, just as it all worked out, like, it was just more and more, like, this is God. And another thing is that I am not a risk taker, and I am very, like, again.
No, you're not. No. This is another thing. I was like, she's not a risk taker. Like, this is so, like, not normally, like, what you
I am a worrier.
Yeah.
And I worry about everything, and I get, like, anxiety a bit, and I just was so calm about this and, like, not worried whatsoever. And so that was just so much, like, man, this is a God thing. And my husband was a bit worried and was super compassionate when he told me that. And I was like, you just need to pray more.
Come on, Mike. That's the best pastor answer ever. Just pray more. Just pray more.
So just all along, like, I feel like as it was going, the more and more it went, and the more that I found out about, like, the person I was matched with and how they had such a hard time matching this person with anything, like, it was just more and more, like, this is definitely a God thing.
That's cool. So what happened, so, you know, you donated the kidney, and what has happened afterwards, the kind of the understanding after obedience, what have you seen, what has come to light, and all that?
So going into it, because I didn't know the person, the only communication you're guaranteed is that you can write them a letter. But you're not guaranteed that you're hear from them, you'll know the results, nothing like that. So I wrote a letter and just explained why I was doing this. And God loved this person so much, and that's why I was doing it. And I included my email address in it. And a couple weeks later, I actually got an email back from the person. So all I knew is that they were in Minnesota. So it ended up that it was a 25-year-old in Minnesota, and it was actually her second transplant. Her first one, her mom donated to her when she was 15, and her body didn't reject it right away, but it also, like, she never fully healed afterwards. And then after she had it for 3 years, then it just, she got a lot worse and had to, so then it was 7 years that she was waiting for her next kidney and ended up having to go on dialysis, which I don't know a ton about, and I'm sure it's different for different people, but from going through this and hearing from it, it sounds like, you know, for a lot of people, it's something that's several days a week and several hours each day and that kind of thing, and it's just an awful thing. And her body was just, like, rejecting. They try and match you up with someone and mix your blood together and stuff, and her body was just rejecting everyone that they tried to match her up with. And then we were a match. So she got that, and I heard from her afterwards, and it was a couple weeks, 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, and she said she was doing great. She was at home. She wasn't really feeling any pain. Slightly jealous, because I was definitely still feeling pain. But, and that she was doing really well, and we've gotten to email back and forth a couple times and have just continued that on. And one of the exciting things is that as of a couple weeks ago, she had testing done, labs done, and it showed that for the first time in her entire life, her kidney function tested in the normal range.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. That's huge. So I know also Renee actually saved a whole school bus full of children afterwards. Well, no, I'm just joking. But that's the fun part. See, we don't know what's going to happen with Renee, right? I mean, the story's still being kind of, in a sense, written. God knows, but it's cool to, like, anything's kind of possible, you know, and you just open the door to that. And you just never know what the story's going to be.
Yeah,
right?
My last email I sent her, I told her, like, I asked, it's like, you know, now that you have more time and you have, you're able to do more things, I asked her what she's really looking forward to doing now. So I'm excited to hear that answer back from her.
Yeah, we just never know what hangs in the balance of our obedience, do we? We just don't know until we decide to do it. And so I when I read the story, I'm like, that's Katie Jensen, you know, living real life, just being faithful and going, God, I don't know why, I don't see the connections, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, but I'm going to do this thing. It's out of my own character, but because you told me to, because I feel like this is you leading me, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to see what happens. I just want that for all of us, right? I just would love to see our church go, you know what, each of us individually say, God, I'm being so sensitive to your leading and your prodding that I know where you're directing me, and I'm willing to go there even though I may not know why. And so I just wanted to encourage you with that story and say, this is real life. This is not something set 3,000 years ago, whatever. This is real life still, and God is still moving, acting, speaking, leading, guiding, doing incredible things through his people. And so at the end, I just wanted to have Katie pray for some of you right now who are maybe struggling with being obedient, knowing, God, this is what you want me to do, but I just don't know if I can take that step. I just wanted to have Katie pray for you, and just we'll finish out that way. So.